U.S. businesses thrive on Alibaba's online marketplace, where sales by American companies to Chinese consumers added $53 billion to the U.S. economy in 2022. Discover more at AlibabaPowersBusinesses.com.
From the opinion pages of the Wall Street Journal, this is Potomac Watch.
Joe Biden goes to Georgia to pitch federal elections bills as inflation hits 7% year over year. Welcome, I'm Kyle Peterson with the Wall Street Journal. We're joined today by my colleagues, columnist Kim Strassel and editorial writer Jason Willick. On Tuesday, President Biden was in Atlanta, where he called for the Senate to get rid of the filibuster to pass the Democrats' latest version of H.R. 1. This is a bill that would impose a federal election code, essentially federal election rules on all 50 states. And President Biden said that Congress needs to act now to fight Jim Crow 2.0, as he presented it as a historic moment. And listen to this clip.
So I ask every elected official in America, how do you want to be remembered? At consequential moments in history, they present a choice. Do you want to be on the side of Dr. King or George Wallace? Do you want to be on the side of John Lewis or Bull Connor? Do you want to be on the side of Abraham Lincoln or Jefferson Davis? This is the moment to decide, to defend our elections, to defend our democracy.
Kim, what do you make of that? President Biden really amping up his rhetoric there.
Well, he's losing this issue in terms of getting it across the finish line in the Senate. He has not convinced Senators Joe Manchin or Kyrsten Sinema that this rises to the level of breaking the filibuster. They have tried all manner of pressure campaigns. And so now he's attempting to raise the rhetoric out among the public to pressure them that way, and to also show his base that he's fighting on this issue. Now, it's a double-edged sword because it doesn't look as though he's going to succeed in pressuring those two senators to go along with it. So this legislation is going to fail. That could really depress the progressive base. On the other hand, if he doesn't go out there and make the case for it, they may feel as though he's not working hard enough for their priorities. So tough political place to be in, but that helps explain what he's up to.
On the specifics, Biden said he wants these bills in Congress to pass Congress to fight two separate things. One is voter suppression and one is election subversion. And let's start with the first of those, Jason. He says that there's voter suppression going on in the United States. He specifically cited a bill that the Georgia legislature passed, was signed into law last year. But on the specifics, it's not even clear to me that this Georgia law that he's talking about does what he claims it does.
Yeah, and I think it's important to say, in my view, this is probably the lowest point in Joe Biden's presidency from my perspective, because he promised to buttress America's democratic institutions. And here he was attacking them in as sustained a manner as President Trump ever did in telling Americans that their votes don't count. And to your point about the Georgia law, that's just not true. I mean, the Georgia law enshrines mail-in voting, which did not exist, or no excuse mail-in voting, which didn't exist there before the 2020 elections. It gets rid of signature matching to give voters a number to put on their ballot instead of poll workers comparing handwriting. There's some sort of unseemly provisions that, at least one in my view, that might have been left out, where it bans people from distributing food and drink to those waiting in line at the polls. But that's intended to prevent sort of lobbying of voters as they're waiting in line. But I think the law could have done without that. But in terms of overall access to the polls, in terms of drop boxes, in terms of mail-in voting, in terms of early voting days, it's a tad more restrictive than it was in the 2020 election, when the pandemic created a bunch of exceptions and expanded a bunch of voting. But it's not much more restrictive, or even at all more restrictive, from what I can see, than the Georgia elections were in 2018 or 2016 or 2014.
And there are some states, Georgia has had no excuses mail balloting for a long time. I think what you were referencing earlier, Jason, was drop boxes. There were no drop boxes in Georgia before 2020, and then they created this pandemic exception. Now they've tightened the rules, but the drop boxes are enshrined in this new law. And Kim, that's a good example of of something where I think you could have a real practical debate on what the best kind of law is, and a good faith debate. So in 2020, in my town, I put my mail-in ballot into a Dropbox. It was a Dropbox located on city property right outside the police station in a commuter parking lot that I believe is under constant surveillance. And so to me, that seemed reasonably secure. There are other people who disagree about that. I suppose it depends in part on where the drop boxes are, how often the ballots are picked up. I mean, here's a news story from October 20, 2020. A ballot drop box in a majority Latino town in California was set on fire Sunday night, which may have destroyed up to 100 ballots 2 weeks before the November 3rd election, unquote. And so on one hand, Kim, I think those are probably pretty rare events. On the other hand, I don't think that the people who say these drop boxes should be in city buildings, I don't think that they have no good arguments.
Right. Well, to your point, you can have a good faith debate on lots of elements of voting. And I take your point on all of those on drop boxes, and they're very valid. Yes, on both sides, I think you can argue that there's this balance between making it easier to vote and having integrity of the vote and having people feel confident that every vote is counted. Another example of what you're talking about is Texas, which also passed a new election integrity reform in the past year, which really upset Democrats. And their complaint was that it doesn't have 24-hour voting. Now, the reason this came up is that during the last election under COVID emergencies, Harris County, which happens to be the site of Houston, the state's most populous city, used a very unique interpretation of Texas's law to set up 8 voting locations open 24 hours, most of them in Democratic areas. And this caused a lot of consternation because you can argue that it's better to have 24-hour voting and vote at any time. But if you're only doing it in certain parts of the state or certain areas that benefit certain parties, that undermines people's faith in the way voting works. So, you know, its new law does have very, very plentiful hours for voting. In fact, even longer hours than it did before. But it's generally uniform across the state in places where it's allowed longer in any city and counties that have more than 100,000 people in population. So that's another example. And again, Bill Gardner, the recently retired New Hampshire Secretary of State, made this point about the balance between integrity and ease of access. And he likes to point out that states like California have had most of the provisions that Democrats have in HR1 that they want to impose everywhere else. That state has had them for ages. And yet, every presidential election, it ranks nearly last in terms of voter turnout. So just because you make something a lot, quote, easier, it doesn't mean you increase turnout, because often what it does is it just discourages people from voting at all.
And just because you impose some kind of requirement, it doesn't mean that voting is all that more difficult either. And that's been the academic research on voter ID laws, which have been up for controversy for years. There's a recent study, you can Google it if you want, in the Quarterly Journal of Economics, Strict ID Laws Don't Stop Voters. It looks at 10 years of data, essentially says that there's no evidence that these ID laws have any effect on turnout. But Jason, on the other hand, you hear almost anything and everything being cited as a tool of voter suppression. One of the elements of the Georgia law is they moved back the deadline to request mail ballots, trying to keep in sync with what's reasonable to expect from the U.S. Postal Service. That has been called voter suppression. There was a court ruling last year. I'll just read part of it. This is a federal court ruling. The plaintiffs argue that by not covering the cost of postage, Georgia is imposing an unconstitutional poll tax on absentee voters. And that was dismissed, but this was not some lunatic lawsuit. This was argued by the American Civil Liberties Union. And so there are a lot of these charges, Jason, out there about voter suppression that, if you really dig down into them, to me look like they don't pan out.
Yep. We got an early preview actually in 2021. Iowa is one of the states that passed the so-called restrictive voting laws that President Biden is complaining about. And Iowa had some elections in 2021, you know, in November, the same day that Virginia and New Jersey did, and its turnout was up from last year. So, I mean, it's just not supportable, frankly. These even some of these new ID requirements, some of these shorter ballot windows, it's not supported that they're ending anyone's right to vote, that they're like Bull Connor. I mean, it's just mendacious. It's just lying. And you know, maybe the president knows that he's lying, or maybe he doesn't, but he's telling people falsehoods and convincing them that the election results, the next election results, are not legitimate when that's just not supported.
Hang tight. We'll be right back. You're listening to Potomac Watch from The Wall Street Journal.
U.S. businesses thrive on Alibaba's online marketplace, where sales by American companies to Chinese consumers added $53 billion to the U.S. economy in 2022. Discover more at AlibabaPowersBusinesses.com.
From the opinion pages of The Wall Street Journal, this is Potomac Watch.
Welcome back. Let's move into the second piece of Biden's argument, which was about election subversion. Kim, can you give a sense of what Biden means by that and how he thinks that the legislation in Congress, these bills, would really stop that?
This has become a new theme for Democrats, is not just arguing that they need voting reform, but making the case that one reason it's urgently needed is that the GOP is supposedly already nefariously planning to steal the next election, namely by different state legislatures giving themselves the power to make it easier for them to remove local election officials. And Biden outright said that in his speech. He claimed that Georgia, the Georgia Republican Party, the state legislature has now given itself the power to make it easier for partisan actors, their cronies, to remove local election officials. And he's claiming that this bill that they want to pass, H.R. 1, would prevent that kind of subversion. There's no real evidence of this. There has been a lot of debate out among the states about giving legislatures the power to intervene. No one has really passed anything that would allow that to happen. He does mention the Georgia bill, except for here's the important point. The Georgia law that he is referencing has a standard that says you cannot oust a local election official unless you have clear and convincing evidence of nonfeasance, malfeasance, or gross negligence over a period of at least two elections.
So to Biden's argument, I mean, there are some real ambiguities in the counting of electoral votes in particular that I think Congress could and should address. So one is there's confusion about the vice president's role. One of the arguments by the Trump team last year was that Vice President Pence could unilaterally decide that some electors were not cast in good faith and throw them out. So Congress could pass a bill trying to clarify the vice president's role. Another one is the Constitution gives Congress the power to determine the time of choosing the electors and the day on which they shall give their votes, unquote. So the Congress could say, after Election Day, a state legislature is not allowed to throw out the popular vote and substitute their own electors. But Jason, that none of this is what Biden was talking about. If Biden had come out in Georgia and said, we really need to reform the Electoral Count Act and wring these ambiguities out of the system, we would be having a different conversation right now.
Yeah, as to the subversion point, he's right that President Trump did try to subvert the election results in Georgia, in that he told the Secretary of State that he didn't want him to certify President Biden's victory there. If Brad Raffensperger had complied with President Trump's bullying, he would have eventually been enjoined by a court because, you know, the federal law requires, in fact, the Bush versus Gore decision in 2000 said that under the 14th Amendment, you have to count everyone's votes equally in a presidential election in a state. So that would already be illegal to subvert the vote in that way. But it is something that President Trump has shown he's willing to lean on local officials to try to do. You're right. The president has already said, and the vice president has said, basically, that they don't want to repeal the Electoral Count Act, which is the law you're referring to that sort of sets in motion this ambiguous process after the election by which Congress certifies the outcome. But President Biden, as you said, is not calling for reforming that law. The Freedom to Vote Act that he's pushing does not do anything with regard to that law. So the fears of election subversion, while I think are more well-founded than the fears of voter suppression, because as we've said, I think people are still going to be able to vote as much as they have been in previous elections. The fears of election subversion may be something we should worry about, but we're not hearing any proposals that would do anything about it.
And to the contrary, we're hearing a lot more than that. Here's another clip of Biden's speech on Tuesday.
The goal of the former president's allies is to disenfranchise anyone who votes against them. Simple as that. The facts won't matter. Your vote won't matter. They'll just decide what they want and then do it. That's the kind of power you see in totalitarian states, not in democracies.
To the point that Jason made earlier, your vote won't matter is what President Biden is saying. And what I find so disheartening about this, Kim, is that after all the falsehoods that have been spread about the 2020 election, now we have both sides essentially discrediting American voting.
Yeah, it's outrageous. So much of that speech was simply outrageous. It was just complete, to use a word that Joe Biden likes to use, malarkey. And he knows it. And it's all about politics. You know, there's even some suspicion out there that one thing the White House is angling to do is that if it can't get this voter bill across the finish line, it can at least sow a lot of distrust, maybe even among Trump voters as well, too, and diminish turnout on the other side with some of these claims. But that, again, is a very, very tricky thing, because you could also demoralize your own base and discourage them from turning out to vote. The one little silver lining here I would point out is that while it's very depressing and discouraging to see the president of the United States saying this, while it's very discouraging and depressing to see the former president of the United States saying this, you do have a bipartisan group of senators right now that are working, in fact, on a reform to the Electoral Count Act as being led by Susan Collins, but there are other Democrats along with it. I would wager that if and when this broader Democratic bill fails, that there will be more momentum for that kind of effort. You kind of wish it was the one getting all the attention and the highlight right now. You sort of wish the president and responsible members of both parties were embracing it as the honest solution to what really happened last year and some of the problems. We may still get there, but we're going to have a lot more of this rhetoric in the meantime.
One last thought on this, simply as a matter of political persuasion, Jason, I don't understand what Biden thought he was doing on Tuesday. He has these bills in Congress that he wants to pass, convince these two senators, Joe Manchin and Kyrsten Sinema, to help carve out a hole in the filibuster in order to pass them. And his approach is to go to Georgia and to get up and give a big speech and say, if you don't do this, you are standing with Jefferson Davis. Can you make sense of that, Jason? I mean, why pick a fight that it looks like Biden is going to lose on these bills?
Well, I'm afraid that the only plausible answer, besides the hope that you're going to bulldoze Joe Manchin, as he said on BBB, Build Back Better, he said that the White House and Democrats seem to think that if they just beat the crap out of you, you'll roll over and be submissive. Maybe they think that's going to work this time on Joe Manchin. It didn't work last time. But I'm afraid that the cynical explanation that Kim raised has to be taken seriously, which is when President Trump, before the 2020 election, was saying your mail-in ballots won't count, the media narrative was that he was preemptively trying to delegitimize the outcome. And I think that has to be taken seriously here, that the president, by telling you your vote won't matter, is laying the groundwork for a defeat in 2022 or 2024, being able to tell people that their votes didn't matter and tainting the outcome. I just think that, you know, it's unfortunate, but that has to be considered, because that's exactly what he's saying.
Finally, two quick items of follow-up. On yesterday's podcast, we talked about inflation, and the November figure year over year was 6.8%. Well, now this morning we have the December figure out from the Labor Department. It is 7%. And Kim, all I can say is yikes.
Yeah, wow. The fastest pace since 1982, the third straight month in which inflation has exceeded 6%. If you dig into it a little bit, the core price index, which excludes more volatile categories like food and energy, even it climbed 5.5% in December from a year ago. Again, a bigger increase than November, which really puts paid the arguments that some on the left continue to make that, oh, this is just some weird supply chain issue in the energy sector and in the food sector. No, prices for everything are climbing across the board. And when you start to get to numbers like this, it is really going to begin putting the hurt on average households who are really going to struggle to pay for basic necessities like heating fuel and groceries. And it won't matter that they are getting slightly higher wage hikes, which we've seen this year, because inflation's eating all of it up.
And the other thing I think that works against the White House's story that this is all supply chain issues is just how broad the inflation seems to be. Kim cited some figures here, a couple other ones that stuck out at me. Transportation services up 4.2% and shelter up 4.1%. I mean, Jason, your next apartment and your next Uber are not stuck in the port of Los Angeles right now waiting to make their way to you. They're, you know, that story doesn't hold for the numbers that we're seeing right now.
Right. I mean, in addition to the greed of the meat industry, we have now the greed of the landlords and the greed of the transportation companies. So it's a lot of corporate greed out there.
One last thing is we also talked yesterday about the Chicago teachers walkout, and we got a nice letter here from Jake, who says he's not hearing enough about the position that this is putting parents in. He writes, for parents with young elementary students, they have no option but to ensure there is an adult present for their child, as they cannot legally be left at home alone. Not only is this union disaster hindering kids' education, it is also putting more strain on employers, as parents of these children are now required to miss work, unquote. And Kim, I think it's a good point. I think that's one of the reasons that parents have been so upset about this. I personally have seen Zoom kindergarten, and it is not the true kindergarten experience. Let's just say that.
Yeah, I was just going to say, look, some of us are fortunate enough that our kids have been back in school now for a good long time. But we, all of us, remember those very dark days of the initial lockdown and what it was like trying to manage those kids, stay on top of their homework, keep them in a good frame of mind. By the way, too, that is something we also have mentioned, and this has been out and talked about more, the growing numbers of mental health issues among kids that are stuck in this environment. It just continues to go up. It's really scary. And so it's an incredibly excellent point. And it follows on too to another issue, which is, you know, we've been talking about these jobs numbers when they come out. And one really pervasive issue has just been the huge number of unfilled jobs. This is playing into that as well too. There are parents that had to leave the workforce to watch their kids. They might be willing to go back in. They probably would like to, but if you're going to have school districts perpetually or week by week changing their mind about whether or not they're actually going to let kids into the classroom, there's no kind of continuity there and not enough security to feel confident that you could go back and take a job and do it consistently. So this is also playing into the broader economy too.
Thank you, Kim and Jason. Thank you all for listening. You can email us at pwpodcast@wsj.com. And if you like the show, please hit that subscribe button on your favorite podcast app. We'll be back later this week with another edition of Potomac Watch.
U.S. businesses thrive on Alibaba's online marketplace, where sales by American companies to Chinese consumers added $53 billion to the U.S. economy in 2022. Discover more at alibabapowersbusinesses.com.